Los tres valores de este día.
Okay. All right. So we are holding on Samach Vav on the base about 15 lines or so from the bottom, line begins L. Okay. Okay, we discussed as follows. The Mishnah had said, okay, so you have the barley that was harvested for the Omer. So we said they harvested 3 saw, according to Rabbi Shmuel, on weekdays 5 saw, and then out of that, they once they ground it and sifted it and everything, they wound up with 1 isarin, which is 0.3 of a saw, which became the actual korban omer, and we're going to deal with the next Mishnah, the next part of the procedure, what they did with it. Meanwhile, what did they do with the rest of the flour? Well, we said the rest of the flour, they'd buy back some hekdesh, and anybody can eat it. What happens as far as truma and meiser, and as far as challah? So we said in the Mishnah we had two opinions. We had that the Tanakhama and the Mishnah said that it's chayav and challah, because flour becomes chayav and challah only when you make it into dough, and by the time it's made into dough, it doesn't belong to hekdesh anymore. But it's possible for meiser because it becomes chayav than meiser when it reaches the stage called miruach, after you clean the grain from all the shells and everything mixed in with it, and you pile it up and smooth out the pile, and that happened while it still belonged to hekdesh. Then we had Rabbi Akiva rather saying that, no, it's chayav than meiser as well. So we started discussing yesterday, why should that be? So we had Rabbi Kahana's understanding that Rabbi Akiva would say that the fact that it belonged to hekdesh doesn't change things. It's still miruach was done, therefore it's chayav and hektish. We contradicted that though on the basis of a couple of brachos. So we said that no. The bottom line is, why does Rabbi Akiva say that it's chayav and meiser? Because ultimately hektish only bought to begin with the parts that they're going to use for the owner, the one tenth of an acre. The rest of it never really belonged to hekdesh in the first place. Never really belonged to hekdesh. Then, of course, it's chayav and meiser.
Who's telling you?
Well, so you have, in other words, when hekdesh originally bought it from the landowner where the barley grew, they only paid him for the 1 isarin. They got the whole 3 saw or 5 saw because you need to sift that out to get it. But the rest of it, to begin with, belonged to him. So, right.
How do you want to oppose that? It's unassailable. Nine-tenths were never given to hekdesh.
But according to the Chachamim, we would say that, no, the whole thing belonged to hekdesh. They sifted out what they needed. Now the rest of it still belongs to hekdesh. It's like any other property that belongs to the Beis Mikdash, and therefore it has to be bought back.
One second.
The nine-tenths, according to the Chachamim, the hekdesh paid for the entire thing. Okay.
1 second. When the grain was harvested, from a private field and given to hekdesh.
The pasture, sold, given, whatever, doesn't really matter.
But it was acquired by hekdesh.
How
can Rabbi Akiva then say that 9 tenths was not?
Because Rabbi Akiva would say that hekdesh only paid for the 1 tenth. The amount of money they paid is only meant to cover the 1 tenth.
And if hekdesh paid for the 10 tenths.
Then according to Rabbi Akiva, presumably it would be paltry from Meister. Okay. So, yeah. So that's what it is. Why does Rabbi Akiva say in the Mishnah here that's chayav and meiser? Because hekdesh doesn't pay for the entire thing. They pay only for the 1 tenth of it.
How did you know that?
Because that's Talmud Aruch, who will fear for Rabbi Akiva. It's an established fact that he learned from his Rebbe.
Nobody's denying that.
No, the Chachamim disagree with that.
No, they disagree.
Okay.
Not on that
thing. No, they, right. So they Rabbi Akiva learned this from his Rebbe, and the other Chachamim disagree. All right. So now here, this is where we're holding. The line begins Ella, about 15 lines from the bottom. Okay. Omar Rava. So Rava starts off like this. Shitali de miruach hekdesh poter. It's clear and obvious to me that if miruach was done when grain belonged to hekdesh, again, you donated to hekdesh sheaves of grain, let's say, and then it went through the whole process of being cleaned and whatever, and you wound up with a pile of grain, which is smoothed out, and it still belonged to hekdesh at that point. Rava says, obviously, poter, it will be poter from hekdesh, from meiser. So I feel it on Akiva, like from a chayav hasam, because we just said, the only reason Rav Akiva says in our Mishnah it's chayav and meiser is, to begin with, hekdesh only paid for the one Isarim they need. They never really paid for the rest of it, so it never really belonged to Hekdesh. Ava miruach Hekdesh ba'al mepoter. Obviously, then, the answer is the Chachamim will say, and Rav Akiva will also agree with the basic premise, that if miruach was done when the grain belonged to Hekdesh, then it's not. On the other hand, continues Rava, miruach ha'ovit v'chavim tanoim. Now, the next thing Rava says, so Rava is first pointing out the things that he knows for a fact. After that, he's going to deal with later on Samach Zayin Amud Aleph, he's going to deal with what he has a question on. But first, let's establish some basic facts. Miruach of Hekdesh definitely passes it. Miruach of Hekdesh tanoi. That's right. Miruach is again smoothing. No, Miruach is smoothing out a grain pile. At that point, Nigmar Malachta. At that point, the processing of the grain has been completed, and therefore it reaches the stage where it's higher than Maisa.
That's before the
milk,
right?
It's before it's ground, right? Before it's ground.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's...
Even,
we're in Menachos, actually. You might be looking at Zvachim over there.
A little further back. It's further back.
It's not Zvachim. Okay. Okay, so if it belonged to Hekdesh at that point, Rava says, obviously we said on the basis of the discussion before, both Rav Akiva and the Chachamim agree that it's Potter from Maaseh. What about Miruach Oivit Chachamim? What about if the Miruach was done by a Goy? Tanoim. There you actually have a Machloikas Tanoim, whether it is Chayiv and Maaseh or not. And by the way, this that we're saying, Miruach of a Goy, you have within that a Machloikas Rishonim, do we mean that we're talking about that the grain belonged to the Goy? So it doesn't matter who did the actual job of smoothing out the pile. The question is who it belonged to at the time. Or is it a question of who did the actual work of smoothing it out? Yeah, my point is we're showing him on that topic.
No, it can be done by
a guy. It's possible for it to be done. It's conceivable. Yeah, it's conceivable for it to be done by a guy, right? You can have a Jew who owns a pile of grain and hires guys to workers to do the processing of it, the threshing and then the stacking and whatever.
Two conditions here then. If it's done by a guy, okay, but then...
Okay, one second. What we're saying is, no, forget Hekdesh. Forget Hekdesh. Hekdesh is out of the picture right now. We're talking two different cases. One is where you donated to Hekdesh. As long as the Miruach was done while it belonged to Hekdesh, we know it's possible. Now the second question is, forget Hekdesh. A case where you have grain where Miruach was done by a Goy. Where again, by a Goy, some of the Rishonim learn it means that the grain actually belongs to a Goy.
Right.
Rashi, for example, learns that way every year. And then you have other Rishonim, some people understand that I'm to be saying this way, that it means the primary thing is not who owned it, but who did the actual job of the Miruach.
And if the goy was employed by Yid,
well, then according to that second way of looking at it, it would be possible for Meister, at least on a daraisa level. That's what we're going to, at least according to the opinion, that say that's possible. That's first we're going to deal with the Machloikas Tanoim. But you should understand that when we say over here, Miruach HaOvid Kechavim, you should realize that whether we mean that it belongs to a goy and may have been processed by a Yid or by a goy, or whether we're talking about it was owned by a Yid, but the Goy did the processing, that is a Machloikas Tanoi. That is a Machloikas Rishonim within the meaning of our Gemara. Okay. So Tanoi here is a Machloikas Tanoi, whether Miruach Goy passes it. The Tanya, namely, we learn in a Braisa. Trumin Mishor Yisrael Al Shei Yisrael. You can give Truma from one Jew's grain, on the, or produce, or whatever, on behalf of another Jew's grain. You can take Truma from one goy's produce for another goy's produce, which means, Rashi learns over here, that we're talking about that you bought grain from one goy, you can take, we hold, Rashi says, that the goy does not have, when his ownership of land in Eretz Yisrael doesn't take off the requirements of Truma and Meister on that grain. There's a machlokes about that as well. So, in fact, Tosfos discusses the question over here that maybe that is the underlying machlokas over here. When this braisa that we're bringing over here, maybe the underlying argument is on this question of yesh kinyan. So Tosfos discusses that at some length, but the point is, if we assume that the goy does not have kinyan in Eretz Yisrael, meaning, therefore, his grain is on the same level as if a Jew grew it, well, then that means it would be chayiv and maaser, according to the mayor, anyway. But then the point is, you can take ma'aser from what you bought from one goy on behalf of what you bought from another goy, because they have an equal chiyuv, a ma'aser, according to the man. Umishal kusiyim al shal kusiyim. You can also take ma'aser from grain that you bought from one kusi on behalf of grain that you bought from another kusi. Here also, Tosfos gets into the whole discussion, if you have in many places in Shas, whether the kusim are fundamentally considered Jews, whether they're fundamentally considered goyim. Anyway,
now
they're goyim. After there came the point when they discovered that they're worshipping an idol on Hagrizim, then yeah, we'll learn about that at the beginning of Kulin. That's the Shambay. Okay.
We've
talked about this idea, but yeah, the Gemara discusses it a bit. Okay. Umishal kol al shal kol, and you can interchange from any of these that you want. You can, for example, you have grain that you yourself grew in your own field. You have other grain that you bought from a goy. You're able to take ma'aser, truma, and ma'aser from the grain that you bought from the goy on behalf of the grain that you grew in your own field. Give it a mayor. That's what the mayor says, that they're interchangeable, that they all have the same equal level of field. On the other hand, no. Sure, you can take truma from one Jew's grain on behalf of another Jew's grain. You can take truma from a goy's produce on behalf of produce of kusim. Or from grain of kusim on behalf of grain that was grown by goyim. But these three tanoim say you cannot take truma from a Jew's produce on behalf of a goy's produce, v'loy shal kusiyim, or you can't take from a Jew on behalf of a goy's or a kusiyim's produce, v'loy mishal ovi kachavim mishal kusiyim al shay Yisrael. You also can't, the other way around, to take from a goy or a kusiyim on behalf of a Jew's produce. Now, why is that? These three tanoim, it's not three tanoim. We had Gibra of Meir for Rabbi Yehuda, Gursus Rabbi Yosi for Rabbi Shin. So it's not one against three, it's two against two. Two against two. The mayor and Rabbi Yehuda versus Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon. Anyway, the point is, Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon hold, when the goy did miruach, then that passes it from ma'aser. So therefore, you can't do that. You can't give truma and ma'aser from one thing, which is chayev, on behalf of something else, which is potter, or vice versa. So according to the mayor and Rabbi Yehuda, miruach goy is still chayev. Therefore, it's chayev. It has an equal level of chiyuv with the Yisrael's produce. Therefore, you can take on behalf from one on behalf of the other.
Hold on.
Who the halacha is like is a little bit complicated, actually, because first of all, you get into this whole issue of what miruach goy means. Does it mean that it was that the grain was owned by a goy or that the miruach was done by a goy? But the Rambam actually makes a number of distinctions on the basis of other Gemaras elsewhere. That the Rambam makes various distinctions. Is it that the goy grew the produce and also the miruach was done by him, or is it he grew the produce and then sold it to you, and then you had a goyish worker do the miruach, and then various other permutations? So yeah, it gets a little bit complicated. Anyway, the point is that, returning to our Gemara over here, so again, Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda are saying that the fact that the goy did the miruach doesn't matter. It's still chayev in truma and ma'aser. Therefore, it's just as equally chayev in truma and ma'aser as a Yisrael, as grain where the miruach was done by Yisrael. Therefore, you can take from one on behalf of the other. Whereas Rav Yosi and Rav Shimon are saying that no, that you can that miruach of a goy passes it. Therefore, you can't take from produce that you bought from a goy on behalf of produce grown by a yid, because that would be from something that's chaser on something that's chayev, or vice versa.
Is there any difference between Rav Meir, Yehuda, and Rav Yossi?
Yeah, we just said. We just said exactly the difference.
Not the two between the two.
Oh, within each pair? Well, that's just so far, but we may have something later. Well, we'll see. But right now, as far as we know, we have Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda agreeing on something, and Rav Yossi and Rav Shimon. Right, we have two sides, right. Okay. Fine. Okay, next continues Rava. Gilgul Hekdesh Poter. Now let's consider another thing Rava says, which is obvious to me, is that if a dough is kneaded and rolled, Gilgul actually means rolled out. What?
No,
it's not a question of an answer. It's not an answer. Rava is stating facts so far. We know that Miruach of Hekdesh makes it kosher from Meister. We know that Miruach of a goy is Machloik of Tanoim, whether it makes it kosher or not. Now let's turn to Chav. We know that Gilgul Hekdesh Poter. We know that if the dough was kneaded, if the dough was kneaded while it belonged to Hekdesh, then it is potter from challah. And we know that it's not, because we learn in a Mishnah in challah. Hekdesha yisofa abshala gilgala. If a woman makes her dough Hekdesh before it was kneaded, obviously it doesn't mean a woman. It could just as well be a man, but typically women were more involved in baking. So, the upja asa, and then she bought it back from Hekdesh, and then continued with mixing it. Chayevet, then it'll be chayev and challah, because at the time, the gilgul, the dough becomes chayev and challah, when you reach gilgul, which is basically when the flour and water are well mixed together. So if she, let's say, for example, before pouring in the water, even after pouring it in, but before mixing it properly, she then were to be machdish it, and then buy it back from Hekdesh, fine, but at the time when the gilgul comes, after that, it no longer belongs to Hekdesh. So it's chayev and challah. Similarly, Misha Gilgala, if she gave it to Hekdesh after she had mixed it, Ufda'asa, and then she redeemed it, also Chayev. Same thing, because at the time of the Gilgal, here it's the other way around. First we said there was Hekdesh, then Gilgal. Now we're saying there was Gilgal and then Hekdesh. Either way, the Gilgal took place when it didn't belong to Hekdesh. Therefore, it's Chayev. But the third case, Ikdisha Adshala Gilgala, if she gave it to Hekdesh before she needed it, before she did the Gilgal, the Gilgalah Gizbar, and then the Gizbar, the treasurer of the Beth Mikdash, did the Gilgal. It doesn't actually mean that the Gizbar came to her house and did it, obviously. It means that it's being done while it's the property of Hekdesh. Ba'achakach p'da'asa, and then she redeemed it from Hekdesh. Ptura, then the dough is potter. Shivashach k'ibasa, because of the time of the Gilgal, it was potter. So we see clearly from that Mishnah that a dough that belongs to Hekdesh at the time of Gilgal is potter from Chala. No question about that. Okay, however, boy Rava. So now that Rava says, okay, so we know three facts so far. We know that Miruach of Hekdesh makes it potter, Miruach of a Goy is Machloikas, and Gilgal of Hekdesh makes it potter. Now we have to ask, what about boy Rava, Gilgal of Gechavim Mai? What about if the Gilgal was done by a Goy? And here, by the way, unlike the previous one, where we have the machlokas rishonim, whether it means that the grain belonged to the goy at the time of the miruach, or whether it means that the actual job of the miruach was done by the goy, here, Shita Mekubetas points out that, and many other rishonim also point out, that here it's clearly talking about who it belonged to. And the reason to make, the Shita Mekubetas says the reason to make the distinction is, we're going to say in a few lines that the question of whether Miruach of a Goy passes it depends on the fact that you have an expression in the Pasuk, the Gon Cho, your grain. And Dagon actually means when it sweeps up in a pile. As opposed to, when it comes to dough, there's no Pasuk in the Torah that says Gilgul Cho. There's no Pasuk that says dough that you needed. So therefore, it doesn't really matter whether it's a Goy actually did the kneading or not. There it matters whether it belonged to the Goy at the time of Gilgal or not. And that's, in fact, how it's passing in Shulchan Aruch. That if you, a Jew, own a batch of dough, even if you had a Goy mix it for you, it's still high in Kala. Okay.
And not before,
because it's never high before. But the point is, it's not a question of, again, unlike with Truma and Meiser, where the question is it that it's potter if it belongs to the Goy, or is it that it's potter if it belongs to you, but a Goy finished the processing? Here, with challah, it's definitely only the first way. Only if the Goy owned it would it be, that's what Rava is asking, actually, would it be potter? If a Jew owned it and a Goy did the Gilgal, definitely it would be challah. Okay. So now Rava is asking again, Gilgal is Gechavim Mai. What if the Gilgal was done while the dough belonged to a goat? Now, the question is as follows. Misnatsnan, now it is true that we learn in another Mishnah in Chala, the next Mishnah after the one we just quoted, Gershin is Geyer, if a Ger converts, and we know, of course, the famous idea from the Chidah, why is Gershin is Geyer, because he had a Jewish neshama all along, it just wasn't revealed. But anyway, the Mishnah starts off like this. Gershin is Geyer, v'hoistaloi Issa, he had a batch of dough. So it depends. Is it chayev and challah or not? Not this actual nisgayer. If that dough was made before he became a ger, potter, then it is potter from challah. Misha nisgayer. And if it was mixed after he became a ger, chayev, sofik, chayev. And if it's a sofik, then it's a sofik darai, so therefore it's going to be chayev and challah. No, sofik if it's done before or after he became a ger. So let's say, you know, he went to the mikveh at 2 o'clock. But we don't know, was the dough, did they do the Gilgal of the dough at 1:30 or at 2:30? Yeah. Okay, so we know the Mishnah says that. The question is, Haman Katoni law. The question is, of the two pairs of Tanoim who we discussed before as far as Miruach of a Goy, which one is the author of this Mishnah? That'll affect what we say over here. Namely, one possibility is Divrei HaKolvi. We could say one possibility that Mishnah in Chala about the Ger goes according to all four Tanoim. And we would say as follows, Vafilu Rav Meir Rav Yehuda to Kabachai Vivasam. We would argue like this. Even Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda, who in the Braith that we quoted before, said that Miruach of a Goy still keeps it, still makes it Chayav in Shoma and Meiser, they might say, but it's different when it comes to Go. And the reason is, they would say the Machai Bihotam, that they're Machayev over there in the case of Truma and Maitre from Trodi, but they might Pater over here when it comes to Chala. And why is that? Because we could argue like this. Hosam who dechiz goncha de goncha yisera, because when it comes to the Chiyuv of Truma and Maitre, you have extra time where the Torah says the word de goncha, your grin. And specifically, actually, the word dagon, now you have there's a lot of different words in Hebrew for grain. You have shvua, for example, but yeah, we in Shema, we say you have to have the dagon, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about ones that are in connection with a mitzvah that you have to do with it. So, in particular, the word dagon, Rashi says, the shortish of it, the word digun, means the process of making the stack and smoothing it out. That process, which the Chachamim call the last stage of it, Miruach, is called, in Torah terminology, it's called Digun. Making it into Dagon, basically.
Which is made by Miruach,
right. So now, Rashi says, you have like this. There are three places in the Torah where it mentions the word Digun Cha in connection with Maaseh. You have two in Parashat Re'eh, one near the beginning and one in the middle. And then you have another one, and then you have another one in connection with Truma in Parashat Shoftim. It's redundant. So yeah, you don't need all three times to say Dagon Cha. So therefore, we can argue that we have extra words Dagon Cha. So in other words, one of them, fine, teaches us that you have to take Truma. Two are redundant, right. But we could argue like this, that two of them are extra, and each one of them is a meal, because Dagon Cha means specifically your Dagon, in other words, that it was done by you, meaning under your ownership, or that the work was actually done by you, whatever, as opposed to a guy. So therefore, we could say have a mute aha mute. So therefore, we could say that it means we have a double mute. And as the usual rule goes, a mute aha mute elolavit. If we have two exclusions, then just the opposite. It flips around and it becomes an inclusion.
Don't we say karachos because it says in two different.
No, that would be as far as Kuala Prabhupada Kuala. But now that you mention it, though, Tosfos actually argues with Rashi that Rashi says the three Degonchas that we're talking about are these three, one, two in Re'eh and one in Shoshin. Tosfos says actually you don't even need that. Never mind the word Degoncha. Consider, whoever it says Degoncha, you usually have with it, like we have in Shema, the Tirosh, Chavi, and Parecha as well. Those three Langachos themselves are the three Miyotin. Degoncha, what you made into Dagon, Tirosh Cha, what you made into Tirosh, which is wine, and Yiparecha, what you made into oil. So those themselves. Tirosh actually means that, it's one of the words for wine. I think the Gemara mentions elsewhere one thing that's related to the word Rosh, which means poor, because if a person gets too addicted to it, and they can easily become poor, but whatever, you have. I don't know, but in modern Hebrew, they use the word tirosh to mean grape juice, like the initial juice that it squeezed out, and then eventually it becomes yayin, which is fermented wine. Anyway, the point is that Tosfos says, so never mind three times that it says digoncha twice in Re'eh and once in Shoftim, just the fact that it says digoncha tirosh cha v'yitarecha, those can be the miyotim that we're dealing with. Anyway, the point is, fine, so you have two miyotim, so we would say a miyot acha miyot elolah. With digoncha tirosh cha v'yitarecha, right. Okay, although Tosfos says they still, Tosfos brings that explanation, but they still say they prefer Rashi's explanation. Alright, anyway, the point is that, so therefore we can say we have two miyotim, we have two exclusions, and a miyot acha miyot elul rabbis, the two exclusions end up equaling an addition. So therefore they would say that comes to, therefore a mayor and a Yehuda would say that's where we get that even if a goy does the digun, even if a goy does the miruach, nevertheless it's going to be high. So you could argue that. That you could argue that that's only the case when it comes to Truma and Maaser. But by the way, Rashi asked the question, then how do you know that we come to, how do you know then that we're including a goy? Maybe we're including hektish. Before we said as a statement of fact that if hektish does the digun, does the miruach and the potter, why shouldn't we say higher from hektish and potter from a goy? Rashi says the logic is because a goy, the miruach done by a goy versus the miruach done by a yid are similar in that there's no further thing that has to be done. You take truma and maaser and then you eat it. You don't have to do any further thing. Whereas if it belongs to hektish, if you're going to argue it requires truma and maaser, you'd have an additional step that you need to do. You also need to buy it back from hektish, otherwise it's also banah. So therefore, it's more logical to say that the Torah, the Meir and the Rehuda are going to argue the Torah is telling us to include something that's more likely to include miruach of a goy rather than miruach of hektish. Because hektish is less similar in that it eats pigeon. Okay. Anyway, so they could argue in that case, therefore, it's chayev because of the extra time that it says the gancha. But they would argue when it comes to the case of challah, that's a different thing. After all, the Torah only says twice the word arisei-sechem, which means your dough. And so we would say we don't have that many available. We don't have a miyot achamiyot. Chav arisei-sechem kedei isachem. One would teach us the amount of dough that you need to have in order to be chayav ashir challah. That would be the equivalent kedei isachem, the same size as the dough that you Jewish people have made every day in the midbar. In the midbar every day, when the mon fell and they baked it into bread for their family, they, this is the positive, that an omer of mon fell every day. So Friday there was a double portion, but an omer, which is exactly the same as a shiur challah. No, I mean, it was mon, actually, but it could be made into, it's a positive grind. In fact, it's all oyster, but they could grind it up and use it like flour to make bread. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the point is that So therefore, the one Arisei Seichem teaches us the amount of dough that you need in order to be chayav and challah. It's equivalent to the amount of food that you had every day for each person in the midbar. One oimer, a tenth of an acre. V'chad, that's what he's saying, yeah.
No.
Arisei Seichem is no, it's not the same shorter. No, not at all. Not at all. Arisei Seichem, the shortest is Ayin Resh Samach, which means a dough. Isarin is Ayin Samach Resh, which means ten, which means one day. No, it's one tenth. But it means one tenth. But it has nothing to do. Okay. V'chad arisei seichem v'loy arisei chavi v'loy arisei hektish. And then we would say the other arisei seichem then would exclude where it belonged to a goy or where it belonged to hektish. So we could argue that Rabbi Meir or Rabbi Yehuda could make that distinction. They could agree with this Mishnah and Chala about the case of the ger. And they would say there's a difference between Truma and Maaser. We have three times the Gomcha versus over here where you only have two times of each Seichem, and as it is, we need one of them to teach us about a Shiur Chala. Shittim Kobetes, and so it's not a Mir. Yeah. So Shittim Kobetes and some of the other Rishonim have a different Girsa over here, which is, never mind the Shiur Chala, that we're learning from other words in those Sukkim, but rather the two times of each Seichem, one excludes the Goy and one excludes Hesish. Fine, but the point is, they would still say that there's a difference, therefore, to be chayav with miruach of a goy, but it could be potter in the case of gilgul of a goy. So that's one way of arguing. Continues Rava, oy dilma Rav Yosef Rav Shimon Katani La, or maybe you could say that Mishnah and Chala about the ger is talking only according to Rav Yosef and Rav Shimon, Jekapatri, where they say potter with miruach of a goy, and they would also say in parallel with potter with gilgul of a goy. Abba, Rav Meir, Rav Yehuda, but Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda would disagree because Gamri, Reishis may help them. Maybe just the opposite. Maybe Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda would say, never mind the three times the Goncha and the whole Miyot, Acha Miyot business. Maybe what we would say is that since Truma is called Reishis and Chala is also called Reishis, therefore we have a Zeta Shava between them, and therefore whatever applies to Truma applies to Chala, and therefore if Truma is Chayev, even if it belonged to the Goy, or the Miruach was done by the Goy, whatever, the same thing would be with Chala, and in that case they would disagree with the Mishnah and Chala.
Because maybe Truma
and Chala are similar, both called Reishis. So that's Rava's question. We know that with Hektish it's possible either way. In the case of Miruach and in the case of Gilgul, we know that Miruach of a Goy is a Machlokas Tanoim. Is Gilgul of a Goy also a Machlokas Tanoim, or is it not? Is it that even Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda, who are Machmir over there, would be Makel over here, in the case of Chala? So Rava says, I don't know. And Amar Rava, the Rava says, the bottom line is, I don't know. Yehei Rava de Echdiyei Bechilma. Halabai, may it be Hashem's will that I see the answer to this in a dream. Hoda Amar Rava, then Rava thought it over further, and he says, no, I can come to a conclusion. Manda Amar Mirua, maybe Zaka had a dream, I don't know. Manda Omer Miruach Ha'Ovid Gechavim Poiter. The opinions that say, namely Rav Yosi and Rav Shimon, who say that Miruach of a Goy is Potter, makes it Potter from Shurma and Meister, they would also say Gilgal Ha'Ovid Gechavim Poiter. They would in fact be also the opinions that say that if the Gilgal was done when it belonged to a Goy, it would also be Potter. Manda Omer Miruach Ha'Ovid Gechavim any Poiter, whereas Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda, who say that still Chayim Shurma and Meister, even though the Miruach was done by a Goy, Gilgal of Gechav Meni Poiter, then they would also say that in the case of the dough, that if the Gilgal was done by a Goy, then it doesn't pass already. So in other words, the answer would be that the Mishnah and Chala about the Ger, which says that it's Potter, if it was done before he became a Ger, would only be according to Rabbi Yosi and Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda would disagree with that and say that it's Chayav Yehuda. Now, Eisvei Rapapa L'Rava, however though, Rapapa says to Rava, I have a contradiction to you, because we learn in a braisa as follows. Here's another case involving a goy. Ovid kechavim shehifrish peter chamor v'chala. If a goy sets aside, we know that a yid has a mitzvah of peter chamor, we say it every day in Rebbe Tamsilin, that if you have a firstborn donkey, then you have to redeem it with a sheep. You take a sheep and give it to a kohen. We'll learn about it later this year, Bez Hashem, in the Sechta B'chorus. You take a sheep and you give it to the kohen. And then the Petra Chamor itself is Musabana. You can do whatever you want with it. If you don't, we'll learn over there what exactly can it be with a different animal. Can it be a Shavu Kes? We'll get to that in the Pesach, says Hashem. But basically, the idea is you redeem with a sheep. And the positive thing is, if you don't redeem it, then you have to break the neck of the Petra Chamor. That's Musabana, in other words. Okay. So, Ovid Kechavim Shefish Petra Chamor. So now, for Goy, sets aside a petra chamor, the chala, or he sets aside chala from dough that he needed. Modiim oisei shul potter, we inform him that in fact it's potter. The chalosin, that chalos lazorim, as far as it's chala, zorim can eat it. You don't have to have koyin to eat it. You can have anybody, any yid can eat it. Or petra chamor goes as a ovid boyer. As far as a petra chamor, he can shear it or he can do work with it. Unlike a yid, who would be offered to do that until he redeems it. The goy is allowed to because it has no kusha. But before we continue the argument, by the way, Rashi explains what do we mean by shehifrish petra chamor. Rashi learns that it means that he set aside a sheep for redeeming this petra chamor. But while he was a goy, he had a petra chamor born to him. Then so he set aside a sheep for that purpose. Tosfos disagrees with that.
So he was saying.
So it doesn't matter whether he became a yid afterwards. The point is that yes. Tosfos, though, disagrees with that and says that it can't be because the fact is, even with a yid, if he sets aside the sheep is complete chulin. You have to give it to the kohen, but the fact of the matter is you're allowed to have a na'ah from it. So therefore, Tosfos learns that what it means is that the goy set aside the petra chamor itself and says, I'm not going to have a na'ah from it until I redeem it or whatever. So we inform him that you're a goy and therefore that doesn't apply to you and you can do whatever you want. One other interesting thing in that regard is that somebody points out, Sassemis points out that why are we mentioning only a petra chamor? The reason is because if it was a bechor of a kosher animal, then it wouldn't be so simple. Because the fact of the matter is, a goy is able to donate an animal to carbon. So there it wouldn't be so simple to say that it has no kedusha. But here, where we're talking about a chamor, which is brought to the carbon, then it's a simple matter to say it has no kedusha. That's the point. It might have some level of kedusha if he says that I'm setting aside a bechor. Yeah, it might have a certain degree of kedusha. Well, he can donate oilus and maybe shlomim. We'll talk about in the next parent. But he can't bring a bechor. That's true. But nevertheless, the fact that he says this bechor has kedusha, that might be enough to give it a certain degree of kedusha. Okay. Anyway, the point is. Now, so what do we mention? We mentioned two things that the goy might have done: petra chamor and chala. And one other thing, by the way, before we continue, is when we say that we have to inform him that it's potter, why do we have to inform him? So let him think that it has kedusha. What do we care? The reason is, in particular, because the problem is, if he sees afterwards that a Zor is eating his challah, he's going to think that you're treating your own kodshim, you're treating your own holy things with disrespect. Here I designated this Zor as challah, and you're going and have a Zor here. So we have to inform him that, no, you should know, it wasn't chayav and challah, and that way when he sees a Zor eating it, then I'll understand what's going on. Okay. Anyway, the point is, so we only mentioned Petah Chamor and Challah. Apparently the implication is that if he did designate grain or produce or whatever as Truma, apparently it would in fact have the Dinim of Truma, which is only according to the Meir and Rabbi Yehuda that we said before.
They would have different treatments.
So yeah, that's the thing. Truma and Challah apparently have different. So what do we see? Apparently the Tana of this Braita holds that miruach that was done by a goy does not pater it from truma and meiser. It's still chayav. Therefore, if you were to designate truma, it actually has kedusha. And yet the gilgal owes kachavim poter. And yet we're saying that if he designates challah, then it's not challah, and it's poter from challah, and it can be eaten by zorin. So you, Rav, are telling us that Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda, who say that a goy's grain is chayav and truma, would also say that a goy's dough is chayav and challah, but here we see that not.
So it's a sub-discussion, actually.
Yeah, well, this is Rav Papa is saying, Robert, you had an understanding, you had a certain understanding of the issue about challah. You concluded that Rav Meir and Rav Yehuda would say that he is chayav and challah.
Yeah.
It seems like not. But oid eight say Ravina with Rava, and then Ravina says, I also have a contradiction against Rava. Another Braita says, challah of gecham ba'aret, the challah that a goy designates in Eretz Yisrael, from grain that grew in Eretz Yisrael, that is, or truma say the chutz la'aretz, or truma that he separates from grain that he grew in chutz la'aretz, where, as Rashi points out, even if a yid had grown it, it would only be chayav and truma and ma'aseh did abanan. The here where it was a goy grew it, then it's potter. Moedia noise shul potter. So again, we inform him that it's potter, that it's potter. Chalosay na chalos zorim. Again, the chala will be able to be eaten by zorim once you inform him, so he doesn't misunderstand what's going on over here. Utrumasay enim nabah, and the truma that he designated will not have the dinim of truma as far as that if it gets mixed up with cholin, that it will make the cholin offer. Because it's with a yid, it would be chayav d'rabbanan. Implying
hot.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't matter the before or after the korban. One sentence. This that you have, truma, this that you have, the produce of outside Eretz Yisrael, chayav and truma and ma'aser, to begin with, that din d'rabbanan only applied to the lands that are near Eretz Yisrael. It never was meant to apply to the countries of Europe, let alone America or whatever. No, those basically Syria, well, Jordan, parts of it are Israel, yeah, that'd be chayav d'rabbanan, whatever. Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, parts of Iraq, parts of Egypt,
yeah,
it would be d'rabbanan.
Even though it's
next to Eretz Yisrael. Because the near Eretz is precisely because they're not in Eretz Yisrael, but near. Yeah. Okay, but here we're talking about a goy. So we're saying that ha-trumaseh ba'aretz asura, apparently the braisa is implying that if he took truma from grain that he grew in Eretz Yisrael, asura umdama, then not only it would be asur for zorim to eat, but it would actually have the same dinim as truma designated by a yid, namely that if it falls into less than 100 times as much cholin, it will make the whole thing asur to zorim. So therefore, again, same problem. Now, the Tana of this Braita is implying, therefore, that if the grain was grown in Eretz Yisrael, even though it was owned by a goy or miruach was done by a goy, nevertheless, it's still chayav in truma, and therefore it has the same dinim of truma as a yid truma. And yet, Google over Kachavim Poter. And yet he starts out by saying, Chalas over Kachavim Ba'aret. The Chala that he takes in Eretz Yisrael is not Chala, and we inform him of that. So again, obviously the Tana of this Braita is making a distinction between Truma and Chala. And Google over Kachavim Poter. So you, Rav, are telling us whoever says it applies to Truma says it applies to Chala, and whoever says it doesn't. Here we have, Papa has one Braita, and then Ravina has another Braita that show not like that. The answer is midrabbanan. this whole concept that we're saying that this whole concept that we're saying that according to Rabbi that according to Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir, the goy zo would be chayiv and challa, would only be drabah. Would only be
drabah.
Yeah. So before we thought we're talking about deraisa level, here now what we're saying is that
that's a huge change.
Okay. Oh, sorry. No, we're not talking about challa. Let me rephrase that. Sorry. Challa, everybody agrees that the goy's dough is potter from challa. When we said before, when we said in the Braisan on Samach Bavam Bay, when we quoted Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda saying that grain that belongs to a goy is chayav in truma, then when meruach of a goy, that is only drabah. This concept that it should be
when we were over there,
over here, this that we said when we started by saying termin mishal yisrael, mishal yisrael, mishal ozik kuchav, mishal ozik kuchav, etc. It means we're talking about it's chayav in truma drabah, not drabah. Well, ugzera mishum bale kitin, because we make ugzera that we're going to impose truma on this grain because of bale kitin. Rashi has two explanations of what bale kitin are. Bale kitin literally means people that have pockets. Like in English, you say people with deep pockets. So one explanation of Rashi then is it means like this. You have rich people who buy, they don't necessarily grow their own grain. They buy grain from people who bring it from donkey drivers who bring it into town. To put it in modern terms, you have truckers who bring grain into town and they buy from them. Now, if you're going to tell me that when they buy from the goy, whatever they buy from the goy, it's potter from Meiser, they may mistakenly think that the same is true if they buy it from a yid. They're going to figure, whatever we buy from the donkey drivers is potter from Meiser. They're not going to realize the distinction. Okay, but here I bought it from a goy and versus here I bought it from a yid. They're not going to realize, and therefore they're going to end up being tempted. That's one explanation of Bali Kitchen. The second explanation of Bali Kitchen is that you have people who own a lot of property. So now let's say they are growing grain on their property. Well, they're growing a lot of grain. Eventually, there comes the point when they have to give Meiser to it. It's going to be a huge amount of truma and a huge amount of Meiser because you're talking about tons and tons of grain, whatever. But let's say you have people who are cheap and they don't want to have to give away all of that amount to the Kohen and to the Levi and to the Anim and whatever, rich people are cheap. Yeah, and sometimes those things tend to go together. Yeah. Okay, anyway. So what are they going to do? They're going to be machne the grain to the goy, have the goy do the miruach, or have it done under the ownership of the goy or whatever, and then it'll be positive. So therefore, to prevent that, the chachamim impose a chiyuv of ma'aser on it, that way these rich people aren't going to try to use it anymore. Yeah. So those are the two explanations of Bali Kitchen. So technically it would be positive if a goy did the miruach. We have this concept because of Bali Kitchen, Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda are going to say we're going to impose a chiyuv of truma and ma'aser on it. However, when it comes to challah, there's no reason to do that, as we're going to talk about now. And therefore, the chachamim didn't make any such creators, and we're left with the original din d'oraisa, according to everybody, that dough that belonged to a goy is potter from challah. Okay, so now the question is, ihachu, well, if you're going to argue like that, you're going to say, because of Bali Kitchen, afilu challah mam. Then you should have the same problem with challah. Yeah, why shouldn't you say the same thing? It could be. If you're mixing up a huge batch of dough, if you're mixing up, let's say, you're making a whole bunch of challahs and pastries and whatnot for a bar mitzvah or wedding or what have you, you could also end up whatever. But that could also, you know, you could be a commercial baker. You could be baking 1,000 pounds of bread every day, and
they're not
obligated
to commercial bakers.
Of course they are. They have a smaller share. Commercial bakers. If they're Jews, absolutely they're chayim. Why do you think? You see on packages of pizza bread and other things, you can always see challah has been taken. And on boxes of masses and whatever, challah is absolutely required. Yeah. You do have a concept. Back when challah was given to the Koyan, you did have that commercial bakers are only required to give a smaller proportion than a private person. The rule is, in the Mishnah, is that a private person has to give 1/24 of the dough and a commercial baker has to give 1/48. Nowadays, that we burn it anyway, that we don't give it to the Kohen, and then either way, you just take a small amount. Because it's going to be burned anyway.
Could a Kohen request it? Could go to the baker and say, I want you to give me one for challah?
In principle, yes. In principle, yes, because as long as the Kohen is only Tomei with Tumas Meh and not with Tumas Yotza all of the group, right? However, the minhag is nowadays that they don't do it.
Right. No, yeah. I'm not saying. Okay. Yeah. Even though you have the Chesed Torah?
Yes. Because first of all, outside Eretz Yisrael, the whole concept of Kala is only Dirabanan anyway. But even in Eretz Yisrael, I think the accepted halacha is also that now it's only Dirabanan. I'm not sure about that, though. But anyway, that's a side issue. Okay, so the question again is, if you're worried about Bali Kitchen, then why are the mayor and the Yehuda applying this only to grain? They should apply it to dough as well. The answer is because the dough, a person wouldn't need to use such loopholes. They have a much simpler loophole. After the Ofila, Pachas Mechamesha, Survoyed, Kemach, Loi. All they have to do is, in order to make it, Pachas from Chala. They don't have to go through anything involving Goyim. All they have to do is knead it, and bake it in quantities smaller than than 1 1/4 kavim of dough, which is the amount, which is a shear house. So therefore, so that we have no reason. Okay, but even so, the point is that if a person wants to do a harama, he has an easier way of doing it than getting a goy involved. Chameshis revoyim kemach va'od is the shear challah. We're going to learn in a couple of prakim in Arma Septa. We're going to talk about there are three different types of measurements that we use that we use in different times in Jewish history. You had midah midboris. Then you had midah Yerushalmis, and then you had midah Sipurit. Each one, the quantities were 20% larger than the previous one.
Sipurit is
a city in the north of Eretz Yisrael, in the Galilee. Anyway, it still exists. Anyway, the point is that so when we say over here Chameshis Ruvayim Kemach, what it actually is in the measurement, in the size of measurements that they used when the Torah was first given, which is called midah Midboris, it was actually 1 3/4 kavans. Which came out to 1 isarin. Then later on, in Yerushalmi measurements, it came out to 6 kavim, because again, they increased it by 20%, and then, or actually sort of by 7.2, whatever, it went to 7.2, then 6, then 5. So that's how it went. Okay. Anyway. They increased the size of the kav, and therefore, I mean, you need fewer kavim, people will say. So therefore, there's no reason to make a zera when it comes to challah, because all you have to do is bake it in smaller quantities. The question is, Trumanami actually got the Lakhir of Oshia. If you're going to go that way, then I have a way of pattering my grain from Truma also without having to involve a goy. I could use Rav Oshia's method. The Omer of Oshia, Marim Odom Atuah, so a person can use a trick involving their grain, or Machnissa B'Mochala, he can bring it into the house still with its straw, still in husks and straw and whatever, where the Gmar Malacha has not been done yet. This way his animal can eat from it, or put him in a meister, and it'll be potter from meister. So all he has to do like that, Rashi actually gives two explanations why it would be potter if you bring it in with the straw. One is because then it's only a meister behemoth, it's not yet fit for human consumption. The other explanation, interesting, Rashi says, is that if you bring it in still inside its shells, in order for grain to be chayav in meister, it has to have two things. You need gmar malacha, you also have to have something called roya pnei abayis. We will talk about it in Bava Metzia and in other places. It has to be that it was brought into the front of the house, or the chaser, the Gemara says over there. Here, if it's inside a shell, literally the kernels of grain have not seen Pnei Abayis because they're hidden inside the shells. Anyway, those are two explanations of Rashi.
You have to unshell them.
So you have to unshell them first and then bring them in, and only then would they be tied in by. Yeah, we're going to talk about that now also. We're going to talk about that you can bring it in Derek Gagas, yeah. Yeah. Inami, or for that matter, the Ayalah Derech Gagas, the Derech HaPefer. The other possibility is, instead of bringing it in through the front door, he could bring it in through the roof, or through the back, or through the back enclosed area, or whatever, backyard, basically. So he could do that also, and make it potter from Meister.
Called also Pnei
Bayis. Yeah, well, that's the point. Now, it's not called Pnei Bayis. If he brings it in Derech Gagas, the Derech HaPefer, it's not Roya Pnei Bayis. Therefore, it would be potter. So therefore, that's a tricky way of getting out of it. So why are we saying that we're concerned about Bali Kisim, where they're going to involve a goy, they're going to buy from a goy, or get the goy involved, or whatever, in order to pass through the grain from Meister, when they could use one of these other methods?
They're not going to run super big amounts of quantities through the garden.
They could. No, not from business. They should have this private house. Yeah, they could. They could.
Oh, it goes also
to... No, we're talking about a private person's house. Oh, yeah, we're not talking about
the answer is to...
That instead of bringing it through the front door of his house, he brings it into the backyard. He brings it into the back door. Yeah. Okay. By the way, also Tosfos gets into a long discussion over here about when we say that an animal can eat from it and be potter from meister. What about can a person eat from it? choices brings that Rashi elsewhere explains that a person can eat from it at that point achilas arai. A person can eat a snack from it, but to eat achilas keva, to eat an actual meal of it, that would be also drabon. Tosfos discusses, and Tosfos says that not necessarily. The person actually may be allowed to eat from achilas keva also in that case. The thing is, No. In other words, he can bring it into the house and then start shelling it. But the point is, the reason why the Gemara uses the expression shehebahem tayachelas is because if you were to ask him why he'd bring it in like that, he's not going to be so brazen as to say, because I don't feel like giving Shur on my day. He's going to use it as an excuse, because I'm trying to bring it in for my animals. But really, he himself would be mutter. Yeah, whatever. Okay. Anyway, the question is that we're saying, Rava is saying before that Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir are concerned that he's going to get goyim involved, bali kissim, and therefore we have to make a zera and make a grain of a goy, that was where miruach was done by the goy, is hide in my intro and nicer. But, and we're saying that on the other hand with go not, because all he has to do is just make it in smaller quantities. Well, the same thing over here, he could bring it in the back or bring it in with a straw or whatever. The answer is hosim b'fahesi zilu de milsa. The answer is, to do such a thing publicly, to bring in his grain like that in full view of everybody, through the roof or through the backyard or whatever, it would be degrading for him. Zila means in the Lashon Mezalzel. It would be degrading for him to do that. He's not going to do that. If people ask him, so why are you doing that? Is he going to have the chutzpah to say, because I don't feel like giving Truma and Meiser? Not really. As opposed to so therefore the Chachamim figured that's not going to be realistic for most people. On the other hand, Bale Kissin is something more realistic, so we have to be good on it. On the other hand, Hacha, the Sina, as opposed to when it comes to making the dough in smaller quantities, you don't bake dough in full view of everybody, you do it in privacy in your house or in your bakery or whatever. Lois Dilla Ben Yosef, so it won't be beneath his dignity. He figures he can get away with it. So therefore, he can get away with it. Therefore, he's not going to bother with having a goy as an intermediary when he knows he can just do it privately by himself and talk to us. Well, that's another matter. But the point is, in other words, at least he has that ability. The Chachamim consider it realistic that he could conceivably do that, and therefore he's going to figure, I don't have to bother having a goy have ownership of the dough or whatever, because if I don't want to give challah, I have that way out of it. That's the conclusion, therefore. So we've reached the conclusion, therefore. Again, that when it comes to hektish, whether we're talking about truma and meiser or whether we're talking about sala, either way, it's closer if the stage was reached when it belonged to hektish. When it comes to truma and meiser, you have the machlokas between the two sets of tanaim. And ultimately, we said one set, Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Shimon say it's closer even to Rabbanon, and Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir are saying chayv on the Rabbanon. And then we have, as far as challah, we say it's potter if it was done by a goy. From three out of the four cases, it's potter, and in the fourth case, they have machlokes. Because, as we said, there's no reason to make a zera when it comes to challah, because nobody's gonna say I have to get a goy involved to be potter from challah when they could instead bake a smaller one.
The zera is not by
challah,
but the zera is by
truma and mindset. Right. Okay. Mishnah says. Okay, so now we've described what's done as far as harvesting the grain and as far as threshing it and toasting it and whatever, and then grinding it. Now we're up to the next stage. You have that one isorin, which is going to be the Kohen Oil. Bolo isorin, so now the Kohen comes to start dealing with the isorin. Nothan olav shamna levana. So he puts on it the proper amount of oil on the proper amount of levana, as usual with a Kohen Mincha. Yosach uvolo, he pours in oil and mixes it together. Rashi over here refers to that there's two applications of oil that are done.
Before the levana,
right. The Mishnah is not necessarily listing things in order. But, So Rashi mentions over here two applications of oil. That you first put some oil in the keli, then you pour the flour on top of it, then you pour the rest of the oil on top of that and mix it together.
Oil, flour,
and then you mix it all together. We'll learn in the next parak, why? But we'll learn in the next parak about it. But Tosfos points out that you actually have an extra step as well, which is that the blila, the mixing of it involves putting in some of the oil at the time also. Okay. The point is that you mix it with the oil. Hainif. They wave it, because we learned in the previous parak that the omer is one of the korbanos that has to be waved. So they wave it in all six directions, like a lulav. The higish, they touch it to the corner of the mizbeach, which again has to be done with almost all menachas. Toma, he takes the kometz from it, the hitzir, he burns that kometz on the mizbeach, the ashar nechal the kodim, and the rest of the omer is eaten by the kohenim, as is the case with most menachas. Okay. Continues the mission. Misha kara ba'omer, as soon as the omer has been offered in the Bet Mikdash on the 16th of Nisan, Yosin, right away, it was possible to go out from the Bet Mikdash, umosin shuk Yerushalayim, shumole kemach koli, they would find that the marketplaces of Yerushalayim are full of flour from roasted grain, or the two different geosauries over here, either kemach koli, which is flour from roasted grain, or kemach vikoli, they find flour and roasted grain, and this is shaloi b'sen chachamim, divrei Rav Meir. Rav Meir says this was against the will of the chachamim. The chachamim are concerned. Now, like this, if you find as soon as the omer is brought, you find flour in the marketplace, and we know that's from new grain. We know we're not talking about from stores of grain from years before. Obviously, they had to have harvested it before the omer was brought. Now, you're not allowed to eat chodesh before the omer is brought. There's a real concern, says Rav Meir, that while you're harvesting it, you may come to eat from it. And that would be also, you'd be over on the issue of chodesh. Therefore, the mayor says, the Chachamim didn't like that this is the case, but they didn't have the ability to prevent it. People are going and doing it, and the Chachamim didn't. Apparently, obviously, if they bring the Omer in the morning on Tet Zayin, they bring it at 10 o'clock in the morning, let's say, and as soon as, and then 10:30, you go out to the marketplace and find it full and find flour over there, they obviously had to have harvested it before the Omer was brought, yeah.
The only problem with eating is they wouldn't eat it.
But that's the thing. Well, that's the thing. The mayor is concerned that while they're harvesting it, they may eat some of it. The fact is, we learn in Bava Metzia, we have the whole concept over there that when you have workers working in your field, they have to be allowed to eat on the job from what they're working with. So like this, if they're harvesting the grain, the mayor is concerned that while they're harvesting or doing one of the other activities and preparing it, they may end up eating some of it.
We don't eat flour.
You could, but first of all, you could. But second of all, they could eat individual pieces of grain. They could. That's what we're saying over there. The workers can do that. The Katak and Malilu,
yeah.
Okay, but first of all, if you're hungry, you'll eat anything. And second of all, again, flour doesn't necessarily mean like the powdery stuff that we buy in the store. It can mean more like semolina, but whatever. Yeah, you wouldn't eat large quantities of it raw, of course. It wouldn't be good for you, but small amounts or whatever, yeah. Or toasted, yeah. Okay, so the mayor says that was shaloi b'sen chachamim. We make a zera that you shouldn't harvest any other grain before the omer is brought. And therefore, that they're selling it right away over there is shaloi b'sen chacham. One second. Rabbi Yehuda omer b'sen chachamim hayoyim. Rabbi Yehuda says no. The chachamim agree. The chachamim say there's no problem with it. Rabbi Yehuda does not hold that there needs to be any such data.
When they used to, after they've brought the omer, could they eat?
They could right away eat chodesh. Sure.
Yashin
could they eat old.
Even after they brought the iron, of course, it doesn't fire.
No, that's the answer. Yeah. So the Gemara is going to focus on the second half of the mission because the first half is pretty obvious. What we said they do with the iron. Okay, so the Gemara asks, "V'loy gozer Rabbi Yehuda drumer ofi l'meichom inay." So you're telling me that Rabbi Yehuda is not going to make a zera that while you're harvesting or doing one of the other activities with this grain, turn it into flour that you might eat from it. But I have a contradiction to that from a Mishnah in Tzachin. Appropriately enough, you know, yesterday, Ber 11th Shir was on Tzachin, and I was mentioning that this year they're learning Tzachin in the Yeshiva, so appropriate now that we're talking about that.
So where is it appropriate to talk about another?
Rabbi Yehuda says, Boykin Ur Abba, you're supposed to do B'dikas Chometz on the night before the 14th of Nisan, as we do, but if you didn't, Uva Abba of the Shachris, And you also have to check if you didn't, then you check in the morning of the 14th over Shasa beer, and if you didn't check then you have to check at the time when you have to do beer chametz, meaning in the 6th hour, but not after that. If you failed to do the beer chametz by that point, Rabbi Horta says too late. Why?
No.
So you're not supposed to do it. You're supposed to do it by night because, oh, I know you're up a little bit different because there's... But if you didn't do it, then you do it the next... But not later than the time of Bir Chametz. And the reason is because Rabbi Yehuda is concerned that while you're doing B'dikah, you may come to eat from what you find. Yeah, you find a good piece of bread and you're going to eat it. The Chachamim, I'm like Bodak Kola, where the Chachamim say that no, if you didn't check the night of the 14th and you do by day, if you didn't do by day, then you check during Chol HaMoed, and you didn't check after Chol HaMoed if you didn't. Because if you have Chomet Shavah on Pesach, salt is eat. If you have Chomet that was left over during Pesach, and you weren't Mavakal, then you can't eat it.
Then why look for it? Then?
You're looking for it in order to burn it. But the point is, the Chachamim tell you, do B'dikas Chomet during Chol HaMoed if necessary, and they're not concerned that you're going to come to eat from it. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda over there is saying that he apparently is concerned that you are going to eat from it during B'dikas Chomet. So why over here is he not concerned that you're going to eat from the grain while you're harvesting it?
Another question. What if the people who eat 2 weeks before Pesach?
That's then you do B'dikas Chomet before you leave.
You can?
Yes. Yes, you can do
here.
That's the ideal time to do it is then. But then Shulchan Aruch, if you have halacha, so you do B'dikas Chomet on the night before you leave. Then you also you use a candle, you do that as long as you're leaving within 30 days before Pesach.
You can do everything.
Yeah. Okay. Let's continue. Omer,
if you leave, how can you do it at home?
You do it in where you're staying. Wherever you're staying, you do B'dikas Chomet there on the night of the 14th. Okay. Omer Rabba. So Rabba answers. Rabba says on the side. Shiny chadash, yes, but it's different when it comes to chadash. Because like this, you're not allowed to, before the omer is harvested, you're not allowed to harvest it in the normal way using a sickle. All you can do is you can pick individual stalks of grain.
And how do you find the market?
So if you have a lot of people working in the field, you can wind up picking quite a lot. But the point is, since you're only allowed to do it that way, Zofuhu, therefore you're going to remember, hey, this is Kaddish and it's off limits, so therefore, to be hard to figure, there's no reason to make it zero.
It's so hard.
Not so much that it's so hard. No, it's just the fact that you're doing it differently. You're used to the rest of the year, you harvest grain, you take a sickle and you cut it, and here instead, the Chachamim are telling you you have to pick it one at a time, so you're going to remember that you also can eat it. Hey, Omole Abayah, Kenach Ksira. Okay, so Abayah says, fine, that explains that then you dealt with the problem about the harvesting. What about chinav ha'kodah ma'ikomer? What about though afterwards you're grinding it, afterwards you're sifting it? Those you're not doing any different for pastures than you're doing the rest of the year. What's going to remind you then not to eat from it? This is holy kasha. Okay, that's not such a big problem. Chinav b'rechayah b'yodah. You can answer that maybe when it comes to grinding, you have to use a hand mill as opposed to a large water-powered or animal-powered or whatever mill. If you still remember how kodah agave nafa, you could argue that you could argue that when it comes to sifting, you have to do it you have to put the sieve upside down, and you do it, and that way that'll also remind you. Okay. However, the Gemara says, still, beisa shochan d'shayet sira. Fine. What about, though, later on in our parak, we're going to talk about that. You're allowed to harvest grain from fields that are watered, from fields that are irrigated. You're allowed to do that even before the omer is brought. Why is that? Rashi says two reasons. One is because a field that has to be irrigated is basically a very dry land. So therefore, if you leave the grain there too long after it ripens, it's going to spoil. So therefore, because otherwise you're going to lose out, then the Chachamim allowed you to do that. That's one explanation. Rashi's second explanation is that grain that's grown in an irrigated field is poor quality grain. You anyway can't bring the omer from such grain. The omer has to come from a field that grows on rainwater. So anyway, you can't rather than irrigated. So therefore, what do you mean? Okay, some fields are irrigated, some grow only on rain. So therefore,
The grain is very good.
Okay, but I guess it would be better if it's from a rain cell. I mean, maybe it could also be different. Yeah, it could also be different in the climate of Israel versus America. I don't know, whatever. Anyway, the point is that therefore, so Rashi says, you can't, we're going to learn later on in our parish, places from which conceivably you could bring the omer, you're not allowed to harvest them before the omer. Places where you anyway can't bring the omer from, like this, irrigated field, then you can harvest them before the omer. So now the question becomes, based on Shochan the Shayek Tira, well then, in an irrigated field, where you are allowed to do the harvesting in the regular way before Pesach, the Tanan, as we learn in the Mishnah later in our Perek, Kotsun based on Shochan Shemal Mokim, you can harvest from the irrigated fields that are in the valley, Avaloi Goichin, but you're not allowed to stack up the grain, because that, there's not going to be any hesed. You can wait for stacking the grain until after the Omer is brought. But then, then what are you going to say? There you, Nela, in a field that grows on rainwater, Rava is saying, or Gaba is saying, that you have to pick them by hand, therefore you don't remember. But what about in a Beis HaShulchan, where you're doing the harvesting in the normal way, according to Rabbi Yehuda, what's going to remind you to not eat from it? An irrigated field, we just said. So therefore, so that's not going to work. According to Rabbi Yehuda, you should have to make a zera because while you're harvesting from such a field, you may forget to eat from it. And the fact of the matter is, it's kadosh, it's also. Elo, I'm not biased. I'm biased. Says, okay, never mind that answer. A different answer. Chodesh bodil minei. Chodesh people stay away from. Because like this, they haven't been eating chodesh the whole year, so they're used to it already. That this is off limits to me until the Omer is wrong. Chometz, my bodil minei, as opposed to chometz, people don't stay away from because you're used to the rest of the year you eat chometz, and all of a sudden now it comes Pesach and you can't. So therefore, there's more of a concern that people may eat from it accidentally. Okay, so that explains Rabbi Yehuda then. That's why he's not concerned for Gzeira in our Mishnah. There's no reason to make a Gzeira with Chodesh because people are not going to eat it anyway.
There's a big difference in appearance and taste between Chodesh and...
I don't know if there is or not, but whatever. The point is, you're used to, if you grow up on a farm, you're used to the idea that there's this year's grain crop and there's last year's grain crop, and then you probably can tell, yeah, you know, it's off limits. Okay. Omer Rava, okay, so Rava says, fine. But you're still left with Rav Yehuda, Rav Yehuda Kasha, Rabbanon like Kasha. Okay, so you've reconciled the two statements of Rav Yehuda here in Sakhin. What about Rav Meir in our Mishnah versus the Chachamim against Rav Yehuda? And usually, who is it that argues with Rav Yehuda? It's usually Rav Meir. So we should assume the Chachamim in the Mishnah in Sakhin is Rav Meir. So then you have a contradiction between them. What are you going to do with that? That we're again here in our Mishnah, they are concerned that you're going to eat chadash, and there they're not concerned that you're going to eat chadash during Pesach. What are you going to do with that? Elo Amar Rava, so Rava says no. Rav Yehuda, Rav Yehuda like Kasha Kiddushanim. To reconcile the two statements of Rav Yehuda, fine, we can use a bias explanation that there's a difference between chadash, which people are used to staying away from, and chometz, which they're not. The Rabbanon, the Rabbanon, like Asher, what about the contradiction between the Rabbanon? The answer is it's not a contradiction because they would say, yes, in the case of Chodesh, we're concerned that he may eat it. But in the case of Chometz, why are they not concerned? Who asked them? Chazer, all of the surfer. The whole point is you're searching for it in order to burn it. Mechal, Ochamine. Are you going to at the same time forget and eat from it? No. So therefore, the Chometz...
I feel bad. You're going to burn it. You're going
to waste it. Yeah, but no. But they, like this, you know that you're searching for it in order to burn for it. Therefore, the Chachamim are not concerned that you're going to come to eat from it if you search for it during Kalam Rites. Okay.
Rabbi Yehuda was concerned about
that? So again, Rabbi Yehuda is concerned that he might, but he would answer that, okay, the fact of the matter is he might forget and eat because Chometz led Bobbim in it, because you're used to eating Chometz the rest of the year. Okay. Rav Ashi says here is another way of reconciling it. Rabbi Yehuda like Asha. The reason Rabbi Ashi is saying there's no contradiction between Rabbi Yehuda's statement, nothing to do with Chodesh versus Chometz, but because Kemach Kolitz, man, because the fact is, our Mishnah said, what did they find in the stores in Yerushalayim? They found flour from toasted grain. Well, that's not something that you can eat. Therefore, there's no problem that people are going to forget, that people might forget and eat it. Because you can't eat it anyway. You can't eat it until it's baked into bread. Okay, that's what it says. However, though, this that Rav Ashi said is barusa. It's something that belongs outside. In other words, it's not a valid answer. Some other places in Shas use instead the expression barusa, which means a fiction. Well, why is that? Peinach mikoli ba'elach, because, okay, that explains once it's been toasted and ground up, sure, then there's no problem that people are going to eat it because people don't eat flour. Ab koli ma'ikonim, or what about the stages until that point? There's a possibility the person may eat it. Why isn't Rav Yehuda concerned about that? You're going to answer, again, like Rabba started out by saying that you have to pick it by hand instead of harvesting it with sickles, and therefore that'll help you remember. Okay, but again, based on Shulchan, the Shayat Sira, but what about, again, in an irrigated field where you are allowed to harvest in the normal way, again, because either it's going to get damaged if you don't, or because you anyway can't bring the oil from such places. Ma'ikonim, then what are you going to say? Why would Rabbi Yehuda not be concerned that you might end up eating some of the kernels of grain then? Ella, hold Rav Ashi, but obviously we have to say that what Rav Ashi just said belongs outside. It's not a valid answer to reconcile Rabbi Yehuda's two statements. We have to use Abaye's answer that Rabbi Yehuda says that Chodesh people know to stay away from and come and say it.
Rav Ashi was arguing
that maybe when he said kenach koli, then he's saying that therefore that's not edible and therefore because you don't eat raw flour and therefore it's not a concern. But the question is, what about in previous stages of it? Why isn't Rav Yehuda concerned about that? Pesach, chametz, people are not used to staying away from it because the whole year they eat it. So, yeah. So
it's not really a good answer.
So, therefore, Rav Ashi's answer is not a good answer, and that's so it's
Berul. Even in the previous stages of it.
That's the point. And then because of the previous stages, it's not a good answer.
And the reason why it's not a good answer in the previous stages.
Because the fact is, during the earlier stages, there's no difference between this grain and any other. It's not once ground up into flour or sugar. It's not edible until you make it into bread. But up until that point, it could be edible. And in particular, what we're saying is, if you're harvesting from an irrigated field, the harvesting takes place exactly the same way before the Omer as it would after the Omer, because you allowed to, because the Chachamim allowed it. So therefore, there's not going to be any hecker, there's not going to be anything to remind you, don't eat from them. So we can't expect Rav Ashi's answer that he's going to remember not to eat from it, because in that case, there isn't anything to remind him to not eat from it.
Hmm.
So that's the bottom line. And that's the point.
Exactly.
That's the point. So therefore, we can't accept Rav Ashi's answer that the reason why Rav Yehuda allows it over here is because flour is not edible, whereas he doesn't allow it over there because hummus is edible. Because the fact is, before it reaches the stage of being flour, it's also edible. Okay. So the bottom line is, therefore, that the bottom line is, first of all, so we've explained why Rav Yehuda over here is not concerned about them eating hummus, and over there he is concerned about eating hummus during Pesach. Again, we have a bias. Explanation ultimately is the one that stands because Kaddush they've known not to eat all the time. Chametz people are not used to staying away from because you only have a week of Pesach that you can't. And then as far as the Chachamim, here they're concerned that he might eat from it during some stage of the processing. Over there they figure he's busy searching for it in order to destroy it, so therefore he already has on his mind that it's all flimus and he's not going to eat it. Yeah, that's the point. While you're doing the medikah, yeah. Well, once he finds it, he burns it. So.
Yeah.
Okay. Just one last thing to mention, is we've talked about before the idea that it mentions in Chassidus that even when the Gemara calls something like this Baruch or Bedusa or whatever, that's outside or fiction or whatever, it's still an essential part of Torah. It's still part of Torah. It's still the same Hashem who gave us the Torah and put His wisdom and will into it and gave it to us. He also determined that this part is not a valid answer. It needed to be stated, but nevertheless, the Machshana doesn't say.
What's the need then?
The need then is it's still part of Torah. It's still part of Hashem's wisdom, and therefore it comes down to us in a form that we can learn on a black Gemara, but nevertheless, as a matter of practical halacha, it doesn't stand.